Tonight on Arena, we remember the life and career of the much-loved opera singer and teacher, Veronica Dudden. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, I'm sure, like myself, you have heard the sad news of the death of the great soprano and teacher Veronica Dudden. She died yesterday at the age of 93. Better known to her many friends and colleagues as Ronnie, she made her debut in 1948 in Dublin in Carmen, playing Michaela. This led on to a successful operatic career, performing in Milan and Covent Garden, also singing with Welsh National Opera, Scottish Opera and Wexford Festival Opera. I interviewed Ronnie back in 2013, and at that time I put it to her that she had managed to land a contract in Covent Garden with the opera house there, and if she could manage to do that, she herself must have been a great opera singer.
Well, I was, but that's past tense. I was. I was Puccini, Mascagni, Gounod, the Marguerite and Faust, Barter Bride, Susanna, and then the Countess, you know, Elvira, and what else did I sing? Good God, I can't remember.
Like those roles sound like a mix of very dramatic roles and some coloratura roles.
Yeah, I was, let's say, lyrics pinto.
Explain that to us now.
Lyrics pinto would be that I sang Aida now, for instance. That's a bit stronger for me. But my voice had a dramatic sound.
Veronica Dudden speaking to me back in 2013, and how amazing it is just to hear her voice at this point in time. She retired from singing, of course, took up teaching young singers, amongst them greats from today's music world, Tara Aracht, Celine Byrne, Suzanne Murphy is in there as well, Niamh O'Sullivan, and the late and much lamented Miriam Murphy. But Veronica went on to set up the Veronica Dudden International Singing Competition. We'll speak more about that and her many achievements later on. But joining me this evening to remember Ronnie, as I'm sure she would insist that we would call her that, is Fergus Shiel of Irish National Opera and one of those students, Tara Aracht. Tara, I know we were listening to a little bit of her voice just before the programme started, and I think kind of stopped you in your tracks when you heard her voice, her singing voice.
Absolutely. Well, good evening, Sean. Obviously a tough period, I suppose, for our musical community yet again in Ireland. But those of us who knew Ronnie like I did and spent so long under her tutelage, it was much, much later in my relationship with Ronnie that I actually heard some of her recordings. Mm. And EMI released a 3-box set for her 80th birthday. I remember in absolute astonishment sitting to listen to them. I mean, she was one of the people who practiced what she preached, because you or I certainly can hear every single technical gem, as she would call it. Like, her voice was fresh from the start to the end. And the interesting thing was, some of those things, especially that "O mio bambino caro" that you just played, that was recorded very, very early in her career, right? But still, in my singing lessons, she was in her 80s and she could sing in the soprano parts for example, The Marriage of Figaro. When I was learning to sing Cherubino, she would sing the Susanna and the Contessa. The voice was still fresh. It still worked. And that is just because she had this most incredible, incredible technique.
And Fergus Shiel, it really struck me when I remember asking her the question about her own singing voice and her own singing career. And as you heard at the beginning of that clip, well, I was. Yeah, but that's all in the past. She was actually quite modest about that achievement. I know she was also into sell the singing competition, and Ronnie was a clever woman. She wanted to stop talking about me. Let's get on to the competition. I want to sell tickets. I know that was part of it, but there was a modesty behind that. I mean, the voice is extraordinary when you listen to it there.
Oh, it's an absolutely beautiful voice. Sorry, good evening, Sean. Yeah, absolutely. I heard that about 6 months ago on the radio, that Omia Bibino Caro. And like Tara, I was stopped in my tracks because it's so beautiful and exquisite in its attention to detail, its attention to vocal production. And what I see Ronnie as is this custodian of a tradition that goes back, you know, really centuries, and it's passed down through people who are absolutely experts. And one of my joys working in opera is to work with people who are so expert and so dedicated. And in Ronnie's case, it was all about the vocal sound, about how you use your vowels, your consonants, how you pronounce your Italian. And this tradition that she had, that she passed on to so many of her students, it's really, I mean, it's such a cliche, I suppose, that it's all gone with her passing. Mm. But it's a really monumental moment, I think, because you build up a lifetime of experience and work and knowledge, and she did so much to pass that on to so many people, but now it's terribly sad that that's gone.
Well, of course, and I mean, we're talking 5 decades as a teacher in this country, so you know, so many singers that have made international careers in the meantime, says Anne Murphy, Patricia Barden, Andy Murphy, you know, the list goes on and on. I'm only knowing ones that I can think of off the top of my head who were in the College of Music when I was there at that time. My own brother, in fact, studied under her as well. But Tara, she had this phenomenal capacity. I was wondering, is there such a thing as a Veronica Dunn sound? But she seemed to be able to actually get to the person. She wasn't interested in, if you don't have a voice, don't come near me, kind of was in some ways the attitude. But she went right into it to try to get the person's voice, not just some kind of nebulous thing, some objective thing. She wanted to get at the person themselves.
Absolutely. And that was the genius in her teaching. I mean, one of the interesting things is that I didn't really realize the genius of Ronnie until I went abroad. And because of the technique I had, other singers were able to say straight away, oh, you must be a student of Miss Dunn. And I couldn't fathom how they knew that. And everybody would say that she never produced a generic sound, but she would find an individual voice and she'd shape a rock into a diamond, is what everyone would say. But because she had the ability and the tenacity also to take the time and pay attention to each person and get to know each person, that she would get you in a position, I suppose, where you were vulnerable enough and you trusted her enough to really, really depend on what she was saying and go with everything she asked you to do. Because as a young student, when you begin to learn a real technique, I mean, it is an out-of-body kind of strange experience, you know? And so the one thing with her was that maybe you or I wouldn't hear the amazing natural sound in somebody, but she would hear something or see something in their personality and she would know that she could sculpt that person.
She seemed to be able to hear whatever blemishes were there holding the back, or some blockage, I suppose, stopping the voice from getting out. She could see the blockage and say, get that out of the way and wait till we hear what we'll get as a result. Fergus, you sat in, you were ordered to sit in on many of her classes. You were studying music in the College of Music, piano in the College of Music at the time, and you were practicing next door. Just tell a little bit about how you found yourself suddenly in the repetiteur seat, playing as an accompanist rather than practicing your own piano pieces.
I mean, yes, absolutely. And I mean, I would have known Ronnie since I was probably 10 years old in the College of Music. She dominated the place as if she owned it. And it was actually later, after she moved to the Leinster School of Music, and I was studying piano for a while with Mabel Swainson, who was next door. And of course, as soon as I emerged from my lesson, I was sucked in to play, actually for Miriam Murphy, at first, but many others as well. And it was just, I mean, you couldn't not be engaged by her personality. She was so magnetic and so commanding. And the world of singing was just so different from the world of piano playing that I felt like it was a foreign language she was speaking. Mm. And yet it was really interesting and really, I wanted to know more, and I became more and more interested. And she was, what I found about her is she was merciless sometimes with her students. She would really, I was saying that she could be, she was like an old school tyrant in some ways, but like really get to the heart of what the issue was with somebody. And be really severe. But at the same time, you always knew that she was doing this to help and to improve and to build you up. It was never, I never heard her say a bad word to anybody, like disrespectful or you know, to knock somebody down. It was all about building people up. And yeah. I thought that was lovely what Tara said about turning a rock into a diamond. That's what she did. She found the essence of the person, and she encouraged them and let them see beyond where they were.
Tara,
and that's the word.
When Fergus said she could be merciless, I heard the laugh of recognition there.
Well, one thing I will say, you know, often a lot now young singers say to me, oh God, you know, how do you prepare for the business? And there's a lot of knocks and a lot of whatever. I say, well, if you survived Ronnie, I mean, Ronnie taught us how to deal with the industry. When I left her, I was ready. And there was nothing was going to knock me down, and certainly nothing was going to get in my way. But that was because she built me that way. Now, she was never cruel, don't get me wrong. But that said, I was in the room when she would say to somebody, listen, I don't want to kill your joy of singing, but I think you should consider doing something else. Because if you can't survive this lesson, the world out there is going to eat you alive. And she was right. And, you know, it's so important that we build up our musicians, that they're fit for the industry. And that was the one thing Ronnie did that I didn't realize during my training, but by God, did she prepare me for that. And so it just doesn't matter what happens now. You just kind of laugh it off and say, well, they didn't say I couldn't sing. There might have been 20 other things wrong with it, but all of those things are fixable.
Everything else is fine. Let me go back to that chat I had with her back in 2013. And I asked her about teaching itself. And ironically, she was reluctant about taking it up in the first place. And I asked her why.
I didn't think I could be a teacher.
What were you worried about?
McNamara asked me to come in, and I went in to the College of Music, and my first student was Anna Caleb, and she was only 14, and I was teaching her singing, and I suddenly found that my ear had taken over. I found I had a very good ear and could get the student to place the voice and actually implement exactly what Hubert Rooney had taught me, because it took me 6 months initially to find a good teacher, because I knew they had me singing dramatic roles.
So in fact, it was a case of reteaching the way you had been taught yourself.
I've been taught myself, yeah.
And if somebody out there right now this evening is listening and thinking, I think I might have a voice, what is the special quality that voice has then?
Well, it must, they must have a natural voice, of course, but how their perspective is, you sum up everything. Would they starve for this? Are they hungry for it? Will they study? Will they be committed? Nowadays, they have to be the ideal thing that you look on television. They have to be a very good musician and languages.
And that's Ronnie Dunn speaking to me back in 2013, and Tara Rockton-Fergus-Shiel with me this evening to celebrate the life and work of Ronnie Dunn, who died yesterday at the age of 93. There you have it, Tara, your list at the end of that, all of the things that you have to be. But it's all about hard work and study, and that's kind of what she didn't suffer fools in that respect. She spotted you. And you know, you were going to the Fechgyol, and in one, she built you up, but she also made it clear that she didn't think you were going to get too far. Explain what happened there.
It's amazing. So I was very lucky, and I, from a very young age, had been studying with Geraldine McGee in Dundalk. And Geraldine McGee and Ronnie had long been friends, but we had never considered that Ronnie would take me so young, because, you know, at that stage, her books were absolutely full. So I had applied left, right and centre, and I had never even put the academy on my CAO form. I arrived to Fechgyol in Dublin for the Operatic Cup, and young Tara thought she was young Maria Callas. So with very big notions, she decided that I would sing the Salce, Salce and Ave Maria from Verdi's Otello, one of the biggest scenes in the repertoire. And I rocked up against all these university students. I actually was the same day as my Leave Insert Music practical. And I walked into that exam and said, out of the six pieces, you can hear one, because I have to go to Dublin, I have to do the Fete. So that just shows the drive I had. But I arrived in Dublin, full costume. We had borrowed kneelers from the church. You can't imagine the drama of the whole thing. And I come out and sing. And at the interval, before they even made the adjudication, Ronnie walks over. And of course, to see Ronnie at the Fete was like, you know, it was like meeting the Queen. I mean, it was this huge, huge thing. Well, like, I'm not going to repeat word for word exactly what she said, but she's like,
ah, please do.
Lovely. No, I better not. We'll be put off the air. She was like, lovely, lovely. Great voice, great voice. Absolutely. Horrific is the word I'm going to substitute. Horrific Italian. Come and see me on Westland Row tomorrow at 10 o'clock. So 10 o'clock the next morning, I go into Westland Row. I sing for her. She makes a quick phone call. Next thing, John O'Connor's in the room. I sing for him. They put me standing outside the door for a couple of minutes and I'm brought back in. And Ronnie said, OK, it's going to be like this. It's too late to put you on any course. So we're going to find another course. We're going to put you on something for a year. You're going to come to me. We'll start. And that was it. I mean, like that, everything had changed. And I mean, I cannot explain to you how excited, but how nervous I was to study with her. I mean, I knew this was like the final piece to my jigsaw of how I was going to become a singer. This was what I needed. You know, it was immensely exciting. And I threw myself in. Had Ronnie said to me, you need to go and drink from the Liffey every day, I would have done it. You know, whatever she told me to do, I did.
But she as she did with so many other singers as well, effectively, there was a period of time when you were preparing for a competition, or I think it was, and she said, right, that's it. You were working in the concert hall. There's enough of this working, none of that talking happening. And home to her house you went, as many other singers did, and you were fed and watered there and prepared it, and I kept on you for the period before the competition.
It was amazing. Yeah. So she made me go for one whole year, cold turkey, no fish. And for a fish addict like myself, that was really hard. So I made a deal with her and I said, OK, I'll do the year, no fish, if you allow me to enter your singing competition the following season. And she laughed it off and said yes. And about 3.5 weeks before the competition, something changed in her mood. And I just kind of presumed it was the stress, you know, of organising the competition. But something changed in her attitude towards me. And one day she was like, I don't want you working in the concert hall late at night anymore. I don't want you hanging out in the college. I want to just come in to do your classes and get straight out. Don't be talking, eat loads of steak. She kept saying I needed to treat myself like a racehorse. And anyway, of course, at 20, I didn't take too much notice. And I'll never forget, it was Wednesday evening and I was working in the concert hall and I was actually working on the reception desk. And Ronnie, cute as a fox, arrived in after a concert had started. And I could literally see her, I mean, the fear of God's coming on me thinking about it. I could see her walking up the stairs into the concert hall and I start shouting for Aidan, the house manager. And I was like, oh my God, I have to hide. She took me in my uniform from the concert hall. She put me in her car and we went back to her house where I stayed. I did not leave until that competition started. I didn't go to a class. I didn't go outside. She honestly fed me like a racehorse. It was unbelievable. Pianists would come to the house so I could practice. Months and months later, she told me she did that because she realized those few weeks before the competition that actually we stood a chance and we had to really pull into fifth gear.
Yeah, I bet you she used the word horrific that night in the concert hall once or twice as well, did she? Yeah, she did.
Oh, I can't tell you what she said, but it was flavoursome.
I'm sure it was. Just one thing, I just want to go back to some of the technical things that she managed. The big thing was this Italianate sound, Fergus, that I think she steered singers towards. It all has to do with the vowels. Will you explain a little bit of that to us and what it was that she achieved with that, do you think? Because again, you've seen it and heard it in singers that have worked with you and I and Owen and other productions, but you also saw it when you were sitting in the room when she was teaching them.
Yeah, I mean, Tara could tell you more about the actual techniques of teaching, but what I noticed was this beauty of sound, I think, would be her primary objective. And I mean, it's so interesting to hear Tara talking there because it was a total commitment she demanded from her students. It was and also a lifelong commitment. Once you're a student of Ronnie's, you were always a student of Ronnie's. So, even when Tara was doing Barbara Seville and La Cenerentola with us, like Ronnie would be there for the Zitzprobe rehearsal, or she'd come in and she'd have her comments and so there was all this total commitment and total involvement in people's lives, not only their singing, but everything, how they manage their careers. So I think one of the things, and just going back to what you said earlier about the different sounds, like you look at the singers like Tara, like Celine Byrne, like Miriam Murphy, Pat Barden, Suzanne Murphy, they're all very individual voices. They're not one type of singer, very different voices. And yet she managed to get this wonderful sound out of everybody. So maybe Tara can tell us more about how she achieved that. But I think there was at its heart this kind of adherence to the Italianate way of singing.
Yeah, maybe explain a little bit more of that to us, Tara, the specifics of this Italianate sound. It's about open vowels, is it?
Absolutely. Ronnie's big thing was that we actually, as Irish people speaking English, we speak quite actually Italian vowels in general. But every single new student of Ronnie's would be sent to Moore Street to buy 6 apples, right? And she would send you to Moore Street as a kind of a masterclass in perfect ah vowels, because that beautiful ah, how are you, that Dublin ah, was, in her opinion, the most perfect Italian and ah we could ever hear. And I used to love this kind of first week every year, because her room would be full of apples and you think, oh, there's been new people. And she sent them down, especially if you weren't from Dublin. It was gas. It was like a rite of passage. But the main thing was that Ronnie would always say, you know, you cannot manipulate the sound. Your microphone is your face, and nobody's face or skeleton really is the same. So her whole thing was trying to find what your natural sound was like and to leave it as unmanipulated as possible, which meant really we place our voices where we speak. So it was really, although quite technical in the background, she had a beautiful way of explaining to people through pictures. Well, certainly for me, it was through pictures. To other people, she could name all the muscles if needs must. But she had this beautiful way of explaining that actually, you know, you don't need a degree from NASA to be a singer. It's all quite natural. We make it difficult ourselves. And this technique then is one of the reasons why people like Ronnie, like Suzanne, sing and sing and sing, and the voices are fresh and fresh and fresh right through the career, right through teaching, right through retirement. And we are so blessed to have that now in Ireland, and that we have so many people that were students of Ronnie's that are teaching, you know, and it's because of Ronnie that that technique is here.
Did she make a ask you to make a promise to teach at some point?
Oh, she did. And I tell you, we had terrible jokes, because I used to say to her, well, you know, I'd be in competition with you and I'll have to wait. And all these, the things we would say, they were so dark when I think about them now. She did make me promise. The one thing with Ronnie was that she committed to something she knew was vitally important. And technique, good technique, is vitally important. There are very few singers that can maintain a main stage career and a teaching career. And she did that for quite a period of time. It also in a time when travel wasn't as easy as it is now and all sorts of things. But she did that because she seen the importance of planting technical roots. Those roots are here. When I was abroad and singing, people would say to me, OK, I'm interested in your technique. Many, many people then came to Ireland to study with Ronnie from abroad. Like it's kind of renowned here now that we have this, and it's part of our heritage. So, of course, it's also very important that those of us that have it give it back.
Well, there you go, Fergus. It mightn't be a bad thing. Maybe it won't be lost with Ronnie. It will be continued on, but not just yet, please, Tara.
Oh, for sure, it will.
Stay singing. Listen, lovely to have spoken with both of you this evening. Thanks so much for those great stories and great memories of an absolute gem of a woman, Ronnie Dunn. Fergus Shiel and Tara O'Rourke there. And let's finish with the voice of Veronica Dunn. And if you ever doubt it, Tara mentioned Verdi's Otello. If you ever doubted that Ronnie was a great singer before she was a teacher, here's your proof.
Ave Maria, piena di grazia, eletta fra le spose, le vergini sei tu. Sia benedetto il frutto, oh benedetta, di tue materne viscere.
Voice of the late, great Veronica Dunn there. And speaking with me before that recording, we had Fergus Shiel and Tara O'Rourke. Ronnie Dunn, her death was announced yesterday. She was 93. Yeshlov J. Goro Ahanam Yilish. The year is 1953. The Emerys are a well-to-do African-American family. He's an engineer, she's a teacher. They have two daughters, Ruby and Gracie. They're moving from North Carolina to East Compton, a handsome suburb of Los Angeles. But no matter how picture postcard pretty the place is, American suburbia will turn out to be the stuff of horror for these new arrivals. And their racist white neighbours aren't the only forces that they have to fear. Them is a new 10-part series beginning this Friday on Amazon Prime. Jen Gannon has been watching it for us and she joins me now. Hardly the first time, Jen, that American TV or film, that the underside of American suburbia is up for all to see. All the pretty pastel colours are there. All the perfect 1950s couples are there too. Has David Lynch got an awful lot to answer for?
David Lynch does, and it also Tim Burton does, because it's very reminiscent, the area itself, of Edward Scissorhands, with the sherbert kind of colour houses and those meticulously constructed lawns. It's like the 1950s nightmare that we're very used to seeing in those kind of shows, or even, you know, Twilight Zone, Stepford Wives. It's all of that influence, definitely. But also, I think the biggest influence on this show is definitely Jordan Peele's dark, those socio-political horror films like Get Out and Us. I think when the trailer dropped for them a couple of weeks ago, a lot of people on social media were talking about the direct similarities between them. Them is a horror story about black life in America at a certain time. And initially, it does look like an amalgamation of the two Jordan Peele films, you know, which one of them was Us, which is about the othering of a black family that are terrorised by their own doppelgangers. And then the insidious racism that lurks beneath middle-class suburbia that was in Get Out. So Them does borrow strongly from Jordan Peele's playbook, but also very much in debt to Ryan Murphy's American Horror Story anthology, I think, and something like the recent fantasy series Lovecraft Country. It's very akin to that as well.
Yeah, because the supernatural elements start to play a part in it, and I'll come back to all of that. But what, just to give it a context here, we're talking about the Great Migration and I suppose the early part into the middle of the 20th century. Give us a context of the Emerys were not the first family to make this journey from the South to what they thought was a better life.
Yeah, so the Great Migration, it's the movement between 1916 and 1970 of around 6 million black Americans who were trying to escape from, you know, Jim Crow era rural South. And the Emerys, they're settling in LA, in the, you know, suburbia of what they think is going to be the peaceful suburbia of East Compton, to be specific. So they were injected into a predominantly white neighborhood that is, as I said, meticulous looking. And really, from the very outset, you're just pushed into this world where the family face straight away indignation and hatred from their neighbours, and led by a very eerie porcelain doll looking Betty, who's played by Alison Pill, and she is determined to run the new family out of her neighbourhood.
In fact, let's have a listen to a clip which features Alison Pill as Betty and others of her neighbours. Incredible group of women. Lindsay Kraft plays Midge and A.B. Cobb plays Nat in this clip that we're about to listen to. And we clipped a very offensive word out of the midst of this, which you'd hear in the middle of the clip. But here they are talking about the black family that has just moved into the area.
I have nothing against the coloreds individually. I have a colored maid. If I were one of them, why would I move someplace I wasn't wanted?
Falsies.
Marty says they only moved here because they were encouraged by the NAACP. You know what Marty says that stands for?
What?
They are actually colored people.
Didn't you see how exhausted she was? Beaten down when they got here?
How can you tell if colored people look tired or not?
Vets don't sweat it. Dale says they'll be out easy.
I'm not sure Dale's right. They're exhausted because they came from someplace worse. They always come from someplace worse. Which means they really want to be here. And if they really want to be here, getting them out won't be easy. We'll have to make this place worse.
What's worse than worse?
Now, Hussein, from Them, the new Amazon Prime series, Betty played by Alison Pill, and amongst the other neighbours that you heard in that clip, Midge played by Lindsay Craft, and Nat played by Abby Cobb. Listening to that, Jen Gannon, who's been looking at the series for us, you really get a sense of just how nasty these people are.
Yeah, I mean, that's therein kind of lies the problem for me, because a lot of the American critics of the show, they've discussed the idea that Them is black trauma being shown as entertainment. And there's a writer, Candice Frederick, who writes for TV Guide, and she was complaining that the series is less a story that uses the supernatural as a lens or a metaphor to discuss racism like Jordan Peele does in his work. It's more an indictment of white racism against black people. And I have to agree that it's supremely tough viewing, as with something like The Handmaid's Tale. I think it's relentlessly horrific. It's just incident after incident that occurs in each of the 50-minute episodes that just pile up on top of each other, from, you know, the very start with the family being greeted with racist dolls hanging from their lawn, and to the neighbours murdering their dog, to the father molding himself to his boss's racist whims, to their teenage daughter Ruby trying to assimilate into a school where her classmates make animal noises every time she talks. And it's very much, you know, it's constant harassment that you see, and you never see the family exist outside of this terror of whiteness. And
is that, but isn't it important that the absolute horror, and at this point we're still talking about a social realism in what you're describing, we'll come to the supernatural side, as I say, shortly, but isn't it important that we don't shy away from all of that? Because at the same time as we have the women doing the apple pie niceness in that scene that we heard, but yet being terribly nasty underneath it, in another room in the house, the men are making their plans to be just as nasty.
Oh, yeah, I understand that completely. But you do kind of wonder, as gradually as it moves on, who is this exactly for? I mean, with black audiences, I cannot see them wanting to revisit this or enjoy watching this narrative of persecution that is not nuanced or subtle in any way. So it robs it of that the natural tension of horror. There's really nowhere to go in this story. Everything is heightened and everything is so terrible that as a viewer, you're just waiting for the next terrible thing to happen, rather than being surprised by something that's insidious, or surprised by something unexpected, which is how great horror and great writing works, even, you know, just to unpeel layers. And I think the right mix of social realism and horror does work well, which we have seen with Jordan Peele. But I do believe that, you know, the story kind of flips back and forth, and we're only supposed to have these 10 days of terrorism that they endure in this neighborhood. So it follows those 10 days, but it also flips back to see what their life was like previously in the South and unravel kind of the mystery of their missing baby son, Chester. And that is all well and good. But then on top of this, you do have the supernatural element to the proceedings, with the youngest daughter, Grace, being visited by a violent phantom and the mother suffering from various visions that may or may not be a result of her deteriorating mental health. So I just feel that there is a general sense of malevolent metaphysical forces at play amongst the visceral horror that's meted out. But I do feel that there needs to be the sense of unease and foreboding within a relatively normal setting that keeps you on your toes as a viewer. And those moments of supernatural horror that are injected into the series, it feels just like another layer of awfulness that this poor family have to endure.
Well, let's listen to one of those clips that gives us a sense of how the supernatural plays in. Deborah Ayorinde plays the mother, and every so often when she's speaking, she just gets everything goes red in front of her, like almost as if the screen is dripping in blood, or we're seeing everything through a red filter. And one of the points when this happens is when her young daughter, Gracie, played by Melody Hurd, starts to sing.
Gone from the earth to a better land, I hear the gentle voices calling back.
Gracie.
I'm coming, I'm coming. For the head is bending low.
Chrissy, you miss enough of that.
I hear the gentle voices calling for.
Chrissy, stop. Damn it, stop. Why won't you stop? Who taught you that terrible song?
It's not a terrible song. It's a good song.
Not for a little girl like you to be singing. Who taught you to sing like that?
Miss Vera.
Miss Vera is just in your book, Gracie Jean. Who taught you the song?
I told you already, stupid.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. You're not crazy anymore, right, Mom?
I'm fine. Mom is doing just fine.
Deborah Iorinde as Lucky Emery and Melody, her Melody Heard playing the daughter Gracie in that clip from Them, the new Amazon Prime series that Jen Gannon is speaking to us about this evening. That's kind of how the supernatural begins to work its way in. I only have seen the first episode. Does it become more and more? Does more of that supernatural seep in as we go along?
It becomes more prevalent as the season goes on, and I think it kind of splits between 5 episodes, which is more rooted in the realism, and then 5 episodes that expands out into the supernatural. But I do feel like that horror falls flat for me because the social horror is so real and a lot more upsetting than any invented threat could be. So I think if they'd wanted to do it a different way, it would have just worked well enough as a social horror story rather than inject that layer of supernatural element to it.
Doesn't sound like a ringing endorsement from you, Jen.
No, I just feel like because all the family are doing is battling against these monstrous people, that the show kind of lacks any real characterization. In saying that, I do think that Deborah Iorinde and Shahidi Wright Joseph as the teenage daughter Ruby do stand out as the best performances because they do manage to find some depth in the characters. But it's beautifully shot. The cinematography is stunning. I mean, it sounds strange saying that because so many horrible things happen, but it has that very luxurious feel of the newness and excitement of the 1950s and that lure of capitalism. And it has a superb soundtrack. It's got bits of Isaac Hayes, Judy Garland, Nina Simone and the Delphonics, and they're used really well to very well affect very poignant moments where they'll inject the sentence with a brilliant song, and I do think that works really well. I mean, I will be interested to see what it'd be like, because it is an anthology series, to see what the next season will be like and if they've managed to get that mix right, because it could work well if it was more nuanced, and I just feel that this story is a bit disappointing because it's a bit two dimensional.
All right, so that's Jen Gannon speaking to us then about Them, the title of the new series, which will be available on Amazon Prime from this Friday, April 9th. The musical accompaniments of guitarist Pat Metheny span jazz, classical, fusion, world music, movie composition and rock. And he remains a record-breaking Grammy winner, having won more Grammy Awards in more categories than any other musician. His collaborators over the years range from legends like David Bowie and Joni Mitchell to the equally respected pianist and keyboardist Lyle Mays, as well as jazz legends like Jack Pastorius. And yet, to many, Pat Metheny remains a mystery. And maybe for some, his music evokes feelings ranging from bewildered awe to dismissive annoyance. So to answer our regular Tuesday question, where do I begin with in relation to Pat Metheny, I'm joined by Jimmy Smith, a guitarist with the RTE Concert Orchestra. Before we get into his music, just enlighten me a little bit about Pat Metheny, the man. Who are we talking about, Jimmy?
Hi, Sean. Pat Metheny, he was born in Missouri in 1954. Musical family. His dad played trumpet, his mother was a singer and his brother was a trumpet player, so he taught Pat early on to play. His first instrument was trumpet, and then he had that usual American Pauline conversion after seeing the Beatles on TV on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964, where he decided to pick up guitar, and he bought a Gibson ES-14, a 140 3/4 size. And then from that, he heard stuff like Four and More by Miles Davis. And then when he heard Wes Montgomery's famous, his seminal album, Smoking at the Half Note, that was it for him. He became a guitar devotee, as well as a Wes Montgomery devotee.
And he became a guitar devotee, but developed a style all of his own, really, that happened during the 80s when he really established himself at that point. How different was the style of guitar that Metheny started to display in the 80s from what had been heard previous to that, if you like?
Well, you know, it's a unique, every artist wants to develop a unique voice. And I think Pat Metheny is a little different in this regard. He's clearly a Wes Montgomery devotee, as I just said, even if their techniques differ, just not to get into too much technicality. Wes played with his thumb and was famous for his more contrapuntal octave playing, while Pat Metheny uses traditional pick and fingers, rock and rolls, jazz style technique. But his approach to music, evidenced by his upbringing and subsequent soul partnership with the great Lyle Mays, the late great Lyle Mays, meant that his musical vision seemed always, to me, orchestral in nature. And from his explorations, the uniqueness of his style developed over time. It's textural, it's motivic, it's symphonic, it's sympathetic, it's highly technical and conceptually proficient. And it demonstrates a kind of a Catholic understanding of all the genres he so far explored. So it's not a simple sound thing.
Yeah. Then his collaboration with Joni Mitchell. I have the In France They Kiss on the Street track here, which I'll bring up underneath this as you're talking. The guitar solo is a little bit of the way in. Tell us about that collaboration with her on the album Shadows and Light.
Well, that's one of my favourite Joni periods, and she assembled a dream band where she had Pat Metheny on guitar, Lyle Mays on piano and keyboards, the great, late great Michael Brecker on saxes, Don Elias on drums, and Jaco Pastorius on bass. So Jaco was kind of the star of the show, but that album is fantastic because Joni, it was a tour album, it's a live album, and she was promoting her latest album, but she did a kind of a greatest hits. So Joni Mitchell was famous for her very harmonically dense guitar tunings. So for Pat Metheny to play, it's a very difficult ask for a guitar player to find a place to play when that kind of harmonic density is happening. And he did, it was fantastic what he achieved in that.
Well, let's listen to it. We'll hear a little bit of Joni first of all, and then it leads into that guitar solo.
France, like us on Main Street, a moor, mama, not cheap display, and we were
Yeah, he makes it sound very easy, doesn't he, Pat Metheny there in that Joni Mitchell track In France, They Kiss in the Street. And Jimmy Smith is with me this evening trying to answer that question of where do I begin with Pat, with the music of Pat Metheny. A touch of the trumpet in there is kind of what you were touching on earlier on as well. It almost is like a trumpet solo, that guitar solo, isn't it?
Well, that one to some degree, but it was, I find this really interesting. He had an obsession with the synclavier and MIDI guitar during the early years. And as a result of MIDI, which is an acronym for Musical Instrument Digital Interface, it's a kind of a device you can put. He literally was playing trumpet on his guitar at some points. So a lot of guitarists I know started off on other instruments, myself included. Actually, trumpet and piano I started off on. And it's kind of hard to shake off the formative influence of the early years on these instruments. You know, it's bound to inform your guitar playing later. As a fan of his, I wasn't overly fond of those MIDI years with that particular trumpet. Now, that sound there with Shadows and Light, yes, but the sound, he literally was sounding like a trumpet at one point. I wasn't.
No, play the guitars with you, Pat. Not, don't be doing the trumpet.
Well, it's sort of. And people reacted negatively, even if unfairly negatively in some cases, you know. But ultimately, an artist creates his own art after all.
What about the classic Pat Metheny band then of the 1980s? You've mentioned the name Lyle Mays a couple of times there. What was special about that group, do you think? That group of players in the band itself?
Well, I think the Travels album, which is, would be one of my favourites, and it, while I think they were that was the quintessential early Pat Metheny lineup because of Lyle Mays. Lyle, there was some sort of a soul chemistry going on between him and Lyle Mays where, as I mentioned earlier on, he had a very Catholic view of music, I think, Pat Metheny did, as did Lyle Mays, and where he invoked the spirit of Bill Evans and people like that, it was all very orchestral, it was very symphonic. And, you know, that album, the Travels album, I think you're referring to, was the result of them touring constantly. So they were a very tight band who had just explored all these wonderful ideas and brought them to fruition. So that's kind of quintessential Pat Metheny listening.
That's a little section of Fizz Dance. That's a live performance, in fact, from the Travels album, Pat Metheny. And it's Jimmy Smith who's speaking to us this evening about where we might begin with Pat Metheny. I was kind of surprised. I suppose I knew it once I heard it, but I don't even have to introduce this piece. I think people will recognise it immediately. Just have a listen. Certainly knew how to go all smoky and quiet, didn't he? That's Pat Metheny and the theme there from Cinema Paradiso. He co-wrote that, Jimmy Smith, with Charlie Hayden, and I think it's Hayden is performing there as well.
No, he did. That's Ennio Morricone, and that's the theme from Cinema Paradiso. So he's played.
Oh, he performed it. I thought he had composed it. So he performed it in that particular case. That shows a very different side of his guitar playing.
Well, that's the interesting thing is that where, and I'll go back to what I was saying earlier on, that that's from the 1997 album. But earlier than that, in the 80s, he'd done the John Schlesinger movie where he'd just written, he didn't play any guitar in it hardly at all. It was Sinclavia with Lyle Mays, and it was more compositional. He'd done stuff with Steve Reich, he'd done the Noise albums and stuff with Derek Bailey. So he'd explored a lot of different things, and everything came back to cinematic theme, you know, kind of motivic playing. And when you listen to Map of the World and hear him doing paying tribute to Ennio Morricone, it all makes perfect sense. It's not jazz and it's not rock, it's not anything. It's more just cinematic music, you know.
Yeah, and 20 Grammy Awards over his career, 12 categories in total, and among them the track that we just heard, he himself and Hayden won that for Best Acoustic Jazz Performance. People are disparaging about him. Some people are disparaging about him. Why do you think that is? What is their problem?
Well, I'm
asking the wrong man, am I?
I don't know why they would be. Maybe his Catholic approach to music offends them. I know that Lyle Mays was to purists and critics are very unforgiving. They're a very unforgiving lot, so they found him a very divisive figure. But if artists listened to them too closely, sure, there'd never be any interest in music created at all. So Pat Metheny's constant explorations of genres other than strictly jazz may have upset purists, maybe. And in all honesty, his trio albums are probably what I would listen to most, and they're very traditional. Yeah, you know, maybe his sound explanations, his willingness to be spontaneous. I saw him many times, but notably at the Albert Hall in 2006 with Lyle Mays, Antonio Sanchez, Richard Bona, fantastic band, just incredible. And in the middle, he did an improv, which was part of his thing. It was literally a free-form that make something up on the spot, like Keith Jarrett did. And it was an amazing thing. But with the advent of iPhones and filming everything and the non-contextual type of ubiquitous Pat Metheny fail mentality, where people would get a 5-second clip, he stopped doing that, which is a great shame in my opinion.
We'll finish up with Road to the Sun. This is him in another mode, very much the classical side of his sound here, Pat, Jimmy.
Yeah, more of it, yes. I think so. And I'm looking forward to all of the new album.
So where would you start? Would you put us back to Joni Mitchell and work our way forward from there?
It depends on where you're coming from. It's the Irish thing. I wouldn't start from here. But if it's somebody, if David Bowie gets you into him, or if it's Joni Mitchell, fine. But I would start with Travels from 1983. But depending on where you're coming from.
All right. Well, let's finish up with Road to the Sun Part 2, current album released March 2021. Thank you. And a little bit there of Pat Metheny, Road to the Sun, an album released in March 2021. And it was Jimmy Smith who was answering that question for us this evening. Where do I begin with Pat Metheny? That is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Keishi. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.